You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gone are the days when being philanthropic simply meant writing a check. As Matthew Bishop and Michael Green explain in their book, Philanthrocapitalism, today's leading philanthropists are employing the business skills and creative energy that made them so wildly successful in business to achieve certain philanthropic goals. The book has just been released in a paperback edition by Bloomsbury, and I'm pleased that it brings Matthew Bishop, the New York Bureau Chief of The Economist, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Is philanthrocapitalism simply what it sounds like, a combination of philanthropy and capitalism?
Well, it is really. It's an interesting movement where some of the most successful business people in the world are actually saying, we're going to give back a lot of our money, and we're actually going to use our brains, the same skills that made us our money, to make sure that rather than just, creating some great edifice, a library or something in my memory, I'm actually going to make sure that I make a difference in the world. And the book was inspired by being at the New York Public Library in 2006 when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates stood there on stage, the two richest men in the world, and said, we're going to give away most of our money to help millions and millions of the poorest people in the world.
And you point out that it was symbolic that Warren Buffett chose the New York Public Library as the place to announce that. Why did he choose to do it at the library?
Well, I think throughout American history, it's been expected of the rich and the successful that they give back. And the library was something in New York that the previous generation of wealthy people got together and funded because they wanted to make a symbol of the importance of learning in New York at that time. And that tradition, I think, is being revived by the likes of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett.
Well, how is this any different than what Andrew Carnegie did? He also believed in giving away most of the fortune and advocated it for others, although most didn't listen to him. But he created library systems. He created other things that continue to not only to thrive, but also to be an important part of our culture.
Well, in some ways, Bill Gates was telling me that he actually looks at Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller as his role models, that in their day they were doing exactly what he's doing. The thing that's different today is
Rockefeller tithed himself.
He did. And the thing that's different today is that they're using different methods, that Gates is looking at global problems, whereas I think Carnegie and Rockefeller were much more domestically focused.
When they give, are there usually strings attached, are you saying, or does the philanthropist actually set the agenda?
The philanthropist does set the agenda today. I think whether it be Mike Bloomberg here in New York or George Soros or the people who founded eBay, they're all pursuing different goals, different problems they're trying to solve, and they want to do it in a way that they understand. I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way that people used to give, and they want to be in control, which does create problems, but it also means they're more likely to be successful, I think.
Well, they used to give it to NGOs, which have been set up by other people to do just the same sort of thing. What's the big difference, other than their names are attached?
The big difference is that, to succeed in business, there's some bad examples of success in business, but there's some really good examples of how you do things on a global scale, that you really focus on performance, that you pursue a strategy, that you actually look at a problem like, how do we fix our terrible public schools here in America? And how do you understand what the source of the problem is? If you're Bill Gates, you're saying, well, I can see there's these different flaws in the system. I'm going to use a business strategy to turn around that school system. And I think that's a way of thinking that isn't completely absent in the nonprofit world, but is pretty rare. And they're bringing these talents to bear on those problems.
So that's not the sort of thing that the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation or the Guggenheim Foundation or the Kroc Foundation would have done?
I think some of those would have done those things. And I think what's interesting is the new generation that has emerged over the last 10 years. Earlier this year, there was a secret meeting in New York hosted by Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and David Rockefeller of that old generation, where they brought together all the leading major philanthropists of this age. Ted Turner, George Soros was there, Michael Bloomberg was there, Oprah Winfrey was there, and there was also a representative of the Rockefeller Foundation. And they are leading this movement, which the book is all about, which is a movement of some of the most successful people in the world to change the world and make it better.
You also are saying that some of the old foundations like the Rockefeller got kind of stodgy, and now there's a feeling that they have to kind of come up to speed, joining these other newer philanthropists.
Well, one of the great things about someone like Bill Gates or Pierre Amidia, the founder of eBay, or getting involved in philanthropy, is that they are aware it's their own money. And they're going to use it as well as they can. Some of the old foundations, the person who created the foundation died 50, 70 years ago, and the people who've taken it over have been bureaucrats, what they call philanthrocrats, and they are much more risk-averse and careful than maybe some of these bold entrepreneurial people.
Also, one of the other differences is that most of these people, or are all of them, people who actually did not inherit their wealth?
Most of them are people who didn't inherit their wealth. Yeah, they created it themselves, and therefore I think philanthropy has been part of their solution to the challenges that being wealthy present. There was this thing called sudden wealth syndrome that was discovered by some Californian psychiatrists in the 1990s, that all these people who made money in the dot-com bubble were really hadn't expected to become wealthy and were troubled by it. They didn't want to leave it to their children because they thought their children would be ruined by the wealth. That's something that Warren Buffett has talked a lot about. And at the same time, they saw philanthropy as an opportunity to solve some problems that they never thought they'd be in a position to solve. And so, I think they are behaving very differently from people who inherit their wealth and maybe feel that the family would look down on them if they gave it away.
You talked about that secret meeting. Didn't that worry some people who heard about it later, who then said, we need some transparency here?
Yeah, I think it was a mistake to meet in secret, or it was at least a mistake not to have a press conference and explain why they were getting together, because I do believe that the reason they were meeting was a good reason. It was that they wanted to solve, for example, the terrible public education problem that America has at the moment, and they wanted to figure out how can they get more wealthy people to join the cause, and in fact how they can help all of us that want to give to be more effective in our giving on issues like, how do you get rid of malaria, that's just killing millions of people a year in the developing world.
And that's something Bill Gates has gotten involved with. Last year he actually started working full-time at his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to focus on issues like education in the United States and eliminating malaria in Africa, among other causes. What I found interesting is that Warren Buffett decided to give his fortune to the Gates Foundation to give away. Why not his own? Is it because he realizes that he doubles the amount at least? We're talking about the richest and the second richest men in America.
Yeah, so this was the unique moment in history when you had these two really successful business people combine their efforts. And I guess it tells you something about different personalities. Bill Gates, when you meet him, he is clearly just so excited about his work that he's doing on malaria and global health. He rocks backwards and forwards in his chair as he gets more and more enlivened by just talking about the subject. Warren Buffett basically is motivated by making money. And he really finds a lot of the people that he would have to deal with if he was actively engaged in giving the money away, the non-profit people. He finds it all a bit dull and would rather be playing bridge or investing billions. And so it's a nice solution for him to hand his money over to someone he trusts, like Bill Gates, and who really gets excited about this. And I think other wealthy people who haven't really got the aptitude for the hard work of philanthropy should follow Warren Buffett's example.
Well, if I remember correctly, for many years he was criticized, so was Bill Gates, for not being philanthropic by the older generation of philanthropists. They were holding on to their money until this new thing came along.
That's right. It was really only when Ted Turner decided to give $1 billion to help the United Nations about 10 years ago that he got up and gave this speech where he attacked Gates and other wealthy people and said, come on, it's about time you stepped up to the plate, that they really started to change. And I think now Steve Jobs of Apple would be the person that is getting the bad publicity for not being philanthropic enough, and it wouldn't surprise me if he starts to be more generous over the next year or two.
My guest is Matthew Bishop, New York Bureau Chief of The Economist, who with Michael Green, who taught economics at the Warsaw University under a Soros-funded program in the 90s, have written a book called Philanthrocapitalism, How Giving Can Save the World. It's just been issued in a new paperback edition with a foreword by Bill Clinton, who is part of this whole process. and some new material as well, and published by Bloomsbury. And a listener asks, here we are talking about Bill Gates, a man who has been accused of all sorts of bad business practices. So how does that, how do we balance off the two? Another case here in your book, you have many nice things to say about Walmart, a company that has been accused of not being, of being a real problem in the third world with its own employees. It is paying off fines, I understand. Just recently it was fined for forcing people to work without paying overtime. So should we admire these people?
That's one of the hardest questions. In the book, we proposed something called the Good Billionaire's Guide, where we set out four rules for how the public should judge someone who claims to be a good billionaire. One is that you make your money legitimately, without exploitation. I think on the whole, Gates, although he has some antitrust stuff later in his career...
As a European, you should be aware of them.
Yeah, but he still made made computing available to hundreds of millions of people, and that was primarily how he made his money. Secondly, I mean, they should pay more taxes than the average person. Thirdly, they should certainly give away a much larger part of their wealth than the average person. And finally, I think it's the most important thing, they should give away their wealth thoughtfully. Their philanthropy should be aimed at really making a difference, and they should be able to demonstrate impact. So I think Gates scores pretty well on all those four points. When it comes to companies, it's much harder to judge exactly what's good and bad. But the thing about Walmart that is so interesting is, although it can be faulted on some of its labor practices, it got involved in Hurricane Katrina when the federal government was failing to do its job. You know, they may have been doing a hell of a job from George Bush's perspective, but they weren't getting the food supplies.
Well, Brownie was doing a great job.
Exactly. Walmart realized that its supply chain, its delivery mechanisms, could get food to the needy people quickly. And I think that changed the way their chief executive saw the world, that he realized they had this huge asset that they weren't using, which was their supply chain. And he said, well, let's actually see what we can do with that on the environment. And so they've now introduced a whole range of products in partnership with sort of non-profits that are, you know, tough judges of whether they're being sincere or not, that have made ecologically, environmentally sustainable products available at their slogan is everyday low prices, which used to be seen as like a niche product for the rich, and now it's something that ordinary people can take part in. And I think that is changing the way the world is addressing its eco problems in a way that no one would have expected. So I think they deserve credit for that, even though they may also deserve criticism for some of their employment practices.
Well, some people tend to discourage the philanthropic efforts of companies like Walmart, criticize them for only taking actions that will improve their own bottom lines or improve their PR.
Yeah, I mean, I think companies have to make money. That's the bottom line. They aren't charities. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't do the things that they can do to make society better. And I think one of the great faults of capitalism over the last 10 or 15 years has been that businesses have said, well, we just want to maximize our next quarter's profits, our next 6 months' profits, and anything to do with society is not our responsibility. And I think as a result, they've missed a lot of opportunities to do well by doing good. And firms like Walmart, General Electric and others, though by no means perfect, are seeing that there are ways they can be, you know, actually a hugely positive force in society as well as making money at the same time. And I think that's great.
My guest is Matthew Bishop, who with Michael Green has written Philanthrocapitalism, How Giving Can Save the World, with a new foreword by Bill Clinton. It is now being issued in a paperback edition by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Did disaster strike the last time you had company over for dinner?
Honey, why is the turkey on fire?
As anyone who's cooked for a crowd knows, catastrophes in the kitchen can happen at any moment. And the Leonard Lopate Show wants to hear your holiday food horror story. Share yours by posting it on our show page at WNYC.org. And on Monday, December 14th, Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchen will be here to swap stories and give us tips on how to avoid culinary calamities. I'm back with Matthew Bishop, the New York Bureau Chief of The Economist, and co-author with Michael Green of Philanthrocapitalism, now in paperback, published by Bloomsbury Press. And your subtitle is How Giving Can Save the World. At one time, didn't many people argue that democracy would save the world, that capitalism could save the world's problems? Now it's philanthropy?
Well, I think the reason that giving really does have the potential to solve some of these huge problems like poverty and our failure of education systems to work, or maybe even some of the issues around international peace, is that governments are very, very bad at innovating. They tend to get stuck in ruts. Politicians lack the courage to go against the grain, whereas private money has much greater freedom. Philanthropy has much greater freedom. So Michael Bloomberg, we talked to quite a lot for the book, and he said when he got elected as mayor of New York, he thought he'd be able to really turn the city itself into a very innovative system of government. But in the end, he found that there was just such risk aversion, such a dislike of taking gambles in the political system, that in the end, he decided to use a model where he got innovative ideas like training principals of schools with a kind of training you'd get if you were a corporate executive, so you really know how to manage a school when you take over, to be funded by philanthropists. And then once it was proven to work, you could say to the politicians, you can put this in the budget without fear that you're going to get bad headlines and you won't get re-elected. So I think the private entrepreneur has a way of seeing potential solutions that governments aren't able to do. On the other hand,
well, government aid often also, since it goes to official channels, as we've seen in many third world countries, winds up in the pockets of a few and doesn't really do the job it's supposed to do.
Yeah, on the other hand, I think none of these philanthropists, even Bill Gates, can succeed on their own. So Gates is giving away $4 billion this year. But he says, the amount of money he has is tiny compared to government budgets. So the New York schools budget is, $15 billion a year. So he has to be effective to form partnerships with governments, with business, with ordinary people and their donations, and to persuade them that his agenda is going to work. And so you look at the Obama administration at the moment, and I think one of the most interesting things is that it's the most pro-philanthrocapitalism administration you've ever seen. The education department is run by people who are really big fans of charter schools, which are more or less all funded by philanthropy. The head of the USAID that's just been appointed used to work for the Gates Foundation, and is going to, I think, bring in all these people that we write about in the book right to the heart of government, and to come up with a much smarter aid policy than the failed aid policies of the past.
Well, Mayor Bloomberg spent millions of his own money to win re-election to a third term last month, actually just barely squeaking in. You've written that he viewed the money he spent on the election as being, in many ways, like the money he gives directly to charity, because being mayor has given him the power to make changes to the city's education system and change public health policies. That sounds like he's thinking plutocracy.
I think he is, in a way, and we used to fear plutocracy as just being... the world.
I still fear it.
I think it's important that it's accountable. But as the electors of New York showed, they gave him a bloody nose. I don't think he really expected it to be that close, and I think it will make him chastened during this time in office. But the point he made in the interview was that, firstly, a lot of politicians running for mayor in New York over the years have not had their own money, and they've had to make a lot of promises to people to get the money to fund their campaigns. And as a result, the city got into a horrible mess. He is free of that. He's beholden to no one else. And so, he can actually do things that are unpopular at times because he hasn't got to pay back some favors that he's given to other people along the way.
James in Brooklyn asks, is there a danger in using billionaires' largesse for things like public education, which should be a right and not a gift?
I think there is a danger if they do it badly. But the thing that I keep coming back to is that there are so many of these problems that the world has failed to solve. And I look at who is out there who's actually going to come up with answers that work. And time and again, I come back to nonprofits and the philanthropists that are funding them, that these people seem to be much more innovative in the ideas they come up with, and they seem to be much more results orientated than government seems to be. And I do think that they are aware of the public's need for them to be accountable. So I'm very struck by how many of them now are starting to say, well, look, there's websites out there like Kiva.com and Donors Choose, which have engaged the enthusiasm of lots of ordinary people in their giving. And let's partner with those and make sure that, you know, that we get feedback on some of these policy ideas we're pursuing. Bill Gates is a big funder of the One campaign, which Bono, the rock star, is associated with, but which has hundreds of thousands of ordinary Americans as members. And so they're working together around an aid agenda that you know, involves everyone from Gates's foundation to the ordinary donation to the government.
And you devote a whole chapter to a group you've called philanthropists, celebrities like Bono and Angelina Jolie and Shakira. Did you come up with that term?
Well, I think Time magazine may have been the first to coin it. I mean, we coined a number of unpronounceable terms, but like philanthrocapitalism itself. But philanthropy is this combination of celebrity and philanthropy. And
many people roll their eyes when these celebrated names are mentioned in this regard.
Because I think there's a lot of, you know, I mean, you think, I mean, Angelina Jolie, who I probably had more cynicism about than almost anyone when I started the interview, but ended up being really impressed by, said this, you know, why should anyone take any notice of what I say? I'm basically an actress. But then it turns out she spent a lot of time in Sierra Leone, saw refugees at first hand, talked to them, listened, you know, has actually spent a lot of time studying. She now has professional advisors. She's working with a lot of experts in the field. And it's not just Angelina Jolie. Bono has this professional organization well-funded by some of these impressive business people. He's himself a very successful businessman. He thinks very hard about how do you solve these problems. And, you know, I'm impressed by the seriousness. Now, he may have some wacky ideas as well, but then everybody has wacky ideas, and some politicians have wacky ideas as well. The test is, do they work? And I think the philanthropists that we write about in the book have a better chance of success than most people.
Well, they also, their name recognition helps them in some ways. How are they regarded by major donors like Gates and Buffett?
Well, I think the fact that at this secret meeting we write about in May this year, Oprah Winfrey was present, I mean, tells you how they view that power. Richard Branson, the British entrepreneur, is another one who, as he says, he can phone up anyone in the world and they will take his phone call. Angelina Jolie said exactly the same thing. And that access and the ability to call people to him. Bill Clinton, classic example, he's using his reputation as a former president to bring into a room all the people you need to solve a problem. And the old way of doing politics didn't allow that possibility. People kept in their little boxes and they didn't come together and work together to collaboratively solve problems.
My guest is Matthew Bishop, who with Michael Green has written Philanthrocapitalism, How Giving Can Save the World, now in a new updated paperback edition from Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have pledged to give away the bulk of their fortunes before they die. They're leaving only small inheritances for their children. Is that a new trend?
Well, it isn't a new trend because Andrew Carnegie, the steel baron, famously said that anyone that left money behind deserved to have it taxed very, very heavily by the government as public repudiation of their unworthy life. So he was pretty tough on that subject.
Well, we'll tell that to members of Congress.
Well, I think it's very striking. You know, one of the things that I hope people will get out of this book is an understanding that not all the rich are sort of money-grabbing people, that actually some of them are doing some really profound things. And, you know, we need other rich people to follow their example.
Do you think that by giving away their fortunes, Gates and Buffett and others are hoping to help their children avoid what's been called sudden wealth syndrome, the sort of thing we see with Paris Hilton?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that Paris Hilton's grandfather, I think, or great-uncle, set up a very large foundation after she was caught up in her drink-driving problems recently. Also, I think time and again, you know, people do look at how corrupting and influenced money can be on children and say, well, look, let's at least maybe let them work for our foundation, but at least they will then learn the habits of doing good and being a good citizen rather than squandering the money on, you know, a sort of drugs or whatever else, fast cars.
According to Forbes magazine, by the way, a fortune that was handed down, last year there were 1,125 billionaires worldwide, up from a mere 140 in 1986, and there are thousands of multimillionaires. Should we assume that that's gone down a little bit because of the economic downturn? But why would it have jumped from 140 to in 1986, not all that long ago, to over 1,100 now?
I think the recent economic crisis has been very bad, but even after allowing for all the wealth that's been destroyed, the last 25 years has been extraordinary for the world economy in terms of countries like China and India, which were really unproductive 20 years ago, have come into the world economy and brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. The business entrepreneurs that have led that process, some of them have become extremely wealthy, and so have our Western companies that have served those markets. And so, you know, you have got a lot more billionaires. And I think...
And there's also a growing gap between rich and poor, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important that we're seeing the Bill Gates, Warren Buffett model of what it is to be a good billionaire getting such publicity. And you see, Bill Gates was telling me that he'd been out in India and China recently meeting with some of the new billionaires of India and China and saying to them, this is how we do it in America. This is how it is to be a wealthy person. You are expected to give away a lot of your money and you are expected to do it effectively. And he is predicting that India and China will become, probably after America, the next most philanthropic countries in the world, which is an amazing thought and a reason to be optimistic at times when we're getting a bit depressed at the moment.
There has been a lot of debate over whether corporations and private businesses are under the same moral obligation as the super rich to give to society. I guess the investors in their companies say, well, your job is simply to make a profit.
I look at firms like Goldman Sachs, which I have a lot of respect for, but I think...
You and about four other people
I think have completely misread what happened over the last year. They would have gone out of business had the taxpayer not stepped up to save them. And so I think, although they've given $500 million away the other week to promote small businesses in America, which is a very well-run scheme and will do a lot of good, it should have been $5 billion. That would have been a starting point in recognizing that they do owe more to society than they did before because of the way the taxpayers had to rescue the financial system. And I wish more of our wealthy people would actually say we recognize that capitalism let people down and that we need to demonstrate our commitment by giving away more money. But, at least Gates and Buffett are showing the way, and I think we will see more billionaires step forward over the next year or two.
Doesn't this also lead to a certain amount of suspicion? I keep on getting emails from certain people who claim that George Soros is running the world. Now, I don't know how much of that is anti-Semitism, how much of that is just the result of the fact that George Soros is a liberal, and how much of it is based on the fact that they see this billionaire who is giving to certain causes and not always the causes that they admire.
Yeah, and Soros is, I think, one of the most effective philanthropists because he does things that are controversial. I think one of the things you can do...
Would you call him a philanthrocapitalist?
I do. I think he's a model for many of the philanthrocapitalists, even if they don't share his particularly liberal views on the world. A lot of the other wealthy people that are taking up philanthropy are saying, well, he actually understands that you've got to take risks. You've got to fund organizations that are doing ideas that are controversial. And, he has made a lot of enemies. I mean, he seems to have a list of enemies that run from Vladimir Putin in Russia to Bill O'Reilly on Fox News, which is quite an achievement in itself. And I think...
I would be proud.
Yeah, exactly. But I think he, he's really made a big difference in promoting democracy around the world, probably more of a difference than any government has done.
A listener in Brooklyn left this comment. It's interesting that you mentioned turning the spotlight on Steve Jobs to ramp up his philanthropic profile. It looks as though he's worth under $5 billion. a pittance. But I've wondered about the complete absence of Steve Ballmer, worth over $11 billion, who has no philanthropic profile whatsoever. I recall reading his responses to a question about that. Too busy, my wife can worry about that.
Well, I think there is a question that everybody who's good at making money has to ask, which is, when do I stop doing that and switch to giving it away again? Gates reached that point when he was around 50. He said, okay, I really want to go full-time with my foundation. You know, clearly, Ballmer has got a number of challenges ahead at Microsoft before maybe he's ready to step down there. But you know, it may well be that he takes it up when he gives up. One of the things I was very struck by with Bill Gates is that he says that he's enjoyed being able to work closely with his wife since he's gone full-time in his philanthropy. And it's been the same with Steve Case and his wife, Jean, that actually they have a lot more fun in their giving phase of their life because they are able to have a more of a family life than when they're just working in a firm. So maybe Ballmer won't just leave it to his wife. He may actually work with her when he comes to his giving. But I would expect that he will, you know, the pressure from having grown up and seen people like Bill Gates at close quarters giving money away, he will probably become a philanthropist as well.
Just one more question. What does this mean for the traditional philanthropies? Are they suffering because these capitalists are creating their own funds?
I think it's not just the traditional philanthropists. It's all the charities that all of us who don't have billions give to. It's all being changed because we want to know that our money is making a difference. That's what fundamentally Bill Gates wants to know. And you're seeing changes in traditional foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation, which has been completely revolutionized, the Ford Foundation, which is going through dramatic changes at the moment. But you see it through sort of the basic charities that we've heard that we all give to, making it much more of a pleasant experience to know, telling us where our money's going, using the internet to give us feedback. And I think that is going to transform how we all give, so that we all know that we're making a difference. And you know, the world really needs that change to happen because there are so many problems out there that need to be solved.
There have been some scandals in the philanthropy world where people running certain charities or doing fundraising for charities make a lot of money, and they say, well, I have to apply the laws of capitalism to doing this, and that means I have to be paid better. But we are shocked when we discover that somebody who may have gotten millions and millions of dollars for a charity made $800,000 himself.
It's one of those difficult moral issues, isn't it? Because I think
these billionaires don't have to worry about that.
Well, I think one of the things that they are doing is saying, well, if we're going to go about tackling a problem like millions of people dying of diseases in the poor world, let's pay what we have to pay to get the best people to work on that task. How is it being more moral if we say, this is what Gates said, he said, look, all these people who are doing research into baldness cures and erectile dysfunction cures in drugs companies here in America, how is it more moral to leave them there because we won't pay people more to get them to switch to do malaria research? And I agree with him. I think if paying people more is the way you get more people into the business of solving the problems of the needy, then that's what you have to do, and that's the most moral way to do it.
Matthew Bishop has written with Michael Green, Philanthrocapitalism, How Giving Can Save the World, with a new foreword by Bill Clinton and new material, now that it's been updated into a paperback edition by Bloomsbury Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.